The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today is Howard Tolman. Howard is the CEO of 1871, which is the tech hub that serves as a community for some of the brightest and most cutting-edge digital designers, engineers, and entrepreneurs working in Chicago. Before joining 1871, Howard was the president and CEO of Tribeca Flashpoint Media Arts Academy. He's a writer, an educator, and someone whose curiosity knows no bounds. Howard Tolman, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
Hey, I'm happy to be here. Thanks, Kelly.
So one of the things that actually completely fascinates me about your career is that although you have achieved tremendous success as a business person, your journey feels like one that is most influenced by mentorship, by schools, by communities. The idea that we can do better in creating environments and cultures for real learning. Does that track for you?
Yeah, you know, look, I mean, our whole model of education started in the industrial age, you know, where we needed to create a factory to turn out in mass people who could perform, you know, functions, not necessarily think, but who could perform tasks. And, you know, I mean, that's dead. It's just a question of when it's going to lay down and let us replace it with things that relate to the future. I'm just a complete convert to the idea of differentiated learning where everybody in the class has to basically learn at their own pace, at their own rate. And the teacher, you know, becomes basically a coach and an advisor rather than, you know, the sage on the stage or somebody who's just talking at people. I mean, it's very clear that we have the technology to do this now. Mm-hmm. And we have to figure out how to make learning fun again. You know, one of the things that always strikes me, and I was a game designer and developer for many years, you know, when you're playing the most compelling game in the world, you're failing 80% of the time.
Right.
And you love it because you start over and you build and you develop skills and, you know, capabilities and things like that. In school, if we had an 80% failure rate, we would shoot everybody, including the teachers, but not limited to the teachers. So there's something missing. I mean, we just haven't figured out how to make students today take responsibility, how to get them excited about education. And so the last probably dozen years has been, in my mind, about building environments that, you know, you said the intersection of creativity and business. The truth is the most disruptive changes these days mm-hmm. occurs at the intersections of anything. So we're constantly seeing technologies jumping from one vertical to the next. And what's so great about 1871 is when you have 2,000 people a day here inventing the future and 450 companies, it's pretty extraordinary. It's just electric in terms of the sort of the juices that are driving it. And to me, it's a logical progression. You know, we started at Kettle, which we moved downtown and rebuilt, and we did Experientia, which was training young kids mm-hmm. to be entrepreneurial and sort of innovative, and then Tribeca Flashpoint, as you mentioned. And now, you know, I feel like we're basically doing the same thing. This is a factory for startups, and it's intended to give our companies all the tools they need to be as successful as possible in inventing new things.
There's a quote by Ken Robinson, who's a great thinker. A lot of you might have seen his talks on YouTube. And he says, "I believe this passionately, that we don't grow into creativity, we grow out of it, or rather we get educated out of it." And I mean, that, you know, unlocking creativity can require unteaching rigidity, unteaching fear, and all these default behaviors, which end up, you know, you do nothing because you're just paralyzed by getting it wrong. And it seems to me you're talking about that.
Yeah. I think he's, I know Ken very well. And I always tell, his my favorite story is his watch story. Where he tells, ask everybody in the audience to raise their hand if they're wearing a watch. And no one under 25 is, of course, because, they tell time in using a digital device now. But, I think that he, he is clearly understands what's going on. And here's the problem. It's very hard to measure creativity. It's very hard to measure innovation. And we're in a culture where, the only thing that matters is what you can measure.
And it's data, all about measure. ROI. Data. Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing, obviously, at Second City, right? We're talking about making and unlocking people's sort of creativity. And then at the end, they're like, okay, so what's the chart that shows how I scored on creativity? And the minute you try to apply a number to that, you're off the path to creativity.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So go ahead.
No, go ahead.
What makes me curious about this, too, is I looked at your – I didn't know where you went to school, and I looked, and I'm like, oh, you went to Highland Park High School, and you went to Northwestern. You got, undergraduate and then your law degree. So you went to what are conceived of as very good schools. I'm curious, was that experience influential in positive ways, in negative ways? I suppose it's both. But, what did you take out of your schooling that led you to this sort of breakthrough of trying to, invent spaces that break out of old models?
I think that my undergraduate education was, just sort of traditional, but that my the selection process and sort of the mentoring that went into my decision to go to law school and, in fact, to pick Northwestern over Harvard and over University of Chicago, was a very interesting sort of fork in the road. I mean, those schools, Chicago at that time, the law school at Chicago was nerd heaven.
Oh, yeah.
And Harvard was insanely competitive. I had this feeling that even as a lawyer-to-be, that I was interested in sort of human components, not simply the mechanical components of the law. And so the reason I eventually stopped being a lawyer was I felt I was only using a fraction of sort of my skills, even as a trial litigator. It still felt like there was a lot more that I could do. And so when we sort of morphed into starting to build companies, every single one has been around sort of getting the culture right first and then building off of that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you write a lot about talent, right? And that sort of human component. And one thing I picked up that you wrote was about intuition. And you said intuition, which can make or break so many things in your business and in your life, isn't something that's given only to the few. It's a skill, one that anyone can develop and one that grows more powerful as you use it. Everyone has the same chance to build his own crystal ball. You just have to do the work and spend the time. And this idea of creativity as a practice and a skill and not something that's created by magic in a back room by just one person, I think is hugely important, because so much of business, and you think about advertising models, have been built on that, only these guys can do this.
Yeah, well, today we say that advertising is the cost of being boring. it's basically a penalty because you haven't been able to figure out a way to engage and connect with people in a meaningful way. And so you try to sort of blunderbuss them into it. But, you talk about creativity. I would say that innovation is exactly the same thing. Innovation, as opposed to invention. Okay, invention is hard. It's like, I got to invent something brand new. Innovation is, I have to successively just get a little bit better at doing this. And every time I do, I sort of move the needle. And so we think innovation is a constant iterative practice, just exactly the same way that Gladwell would say the 10,000 hours, or you would say that the only way you get great at improv is by doing it, by going through the process. So I think all of these are practices. I don't think there's any magic. I think you have to be open to it, and you have to sort of put one foot in front of the other and build.
Yeah, and an important aspect of that, though, is group collaboration and group innovation is different than, you know, the sort of solo act. And we're not naturally oriented to working well in groups. So the thing that's always been fascinating to me about your work, and we first got to know each other when you were at Flashpoint, and you built up community. I mean, you could see it in the hallways, the way people talk to each other, and then the kind of collaborative works that you would set up and have people, you know, create. And these are people who might end up making a game by themselves, but you're never really doing it by yourself in many places. So I think that's important.
I think today nobody does anything important by themselves. In fact, I'm doing the commencement talk at Northwestern Law School, and my favorite line, I'm sure they won't like it, but my favorite line in the talk is to say that, you know, even the business schools, even the new medical schools have figured out that if you're not a good team player, they don't want you. I mean, literally, the medical schools have even decided that. But the law schools are still the last remnants of the litigator-gladiator mentality. It's like the one-man, you know, army, the superhero. And that's just not going to work in the legal profession any more than it's going to work anywhere else. And they just have to figure out, how do you make team an important part of everything you're building?
So this may be completely, you know, off on my part, but one of the things that I do find amazing, given this, you have a great understanding of this stuff. You also have an amazing art collection. And you know, when you think about a visual artist, that seems to be the last bastion of a single person doing their craft by themselves in a room, you know, like theater, dance, music, they all sort of belong to bigger entities. And you know, sort of novelists, poets, and visual artists seem to be the last people who sort of can corner off themselves to create their art. And I do find it ironic that is such a passion of yours. And I wonder if there is a connection or it's just, you know, meaningless.
Well, there's three connections. The first one is at Flashpoint, at Kendall, and here at 1871, you know, I've brought in a lot of the art because in each of those areas, I feel like pure digital is too sterile. And yeah. I feel like we need to celebrate excellence in physicality as well. It's not simply something you can make on a computer. So part one is to just expose everybody to the beauty of art and of execution and have them understand just how challenging and difficult that is. Mm-hmm. Part two is that basically I think, you know, that you're correct in saying that being an artist is solitary, and it's even worse than that. It's like being a writer is also sort of solitary.
Oh, yeah.
And God forbid, you know, you self-edit yourself right out of existence. I mean, an artist is equally critical. But one thing that people don't understand, you know, I was just at the Van Gogh exhibition, which I can't recommend more highly, and
nope. Amen.
some of the interactive tools that they've created in order to show what the differences were between those three paintings are extraordinary. But you know, if you understand how he grew as an artist and how he developed, you know, artists aren't alone because while they're in a room by themselves, they're surrounded by the history of art and all the people that have come before them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, all of the great artists, sort of reference and incorporate and copy. You know, Steve Jobs used to always say, you know, great artists steal. They don't just copy, they steal. And I think that it's important to understand that, you know, everything done sort of in reference to what's come before. And art represents that, too. And then lastly, sort of most selfishly of all, we just started supporting artists, and we did it the last 5 years. We've done, you know, these stipends for artists at a time when a lot of their work, no one was buying art, you know, the last 3 or 4 years in many parts of the world, especially new young artists. So, you know, we have a pretty extensive set of grants that we provide through our foundation. But the goal was that I thought these people were doing meaningful work. I was being a corporate lawyer, and, you know, one of the trade-offs we made was that we started supporting a lot of our friends who were practicing artists so they could practice their art. And that's how, actually, we got into it at the beginning. And, you know, to this day, I mean, I still only am interested in living artists. I'm only interested in sort of watching their work develop. And yet, you know, as you know, it's, as an artist, it's very, very hard. It's, you know, it's hard to have people look at your work and be critical of your work and stuff. So, you know, we also are big supporters of the gallery system because, you know, if we don't support it, I'm not sure what's going to happen. I honestly fear for a lot of arts organizations, Kelly, because I just don't know that this generation, which honestly is into experiences and utility, I don't think they care about owning stuff. And so I don't know what's going to happen to the physical arts. I think dance is fine. I think music is fine. I think, you know, maybe some of the, like the Museum of Science and Industry is fine. But as far as the Field Museum goes, as far as these things that are sort of several generations back, I don't know what's going to happen to the support for those cultural organizations.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, the you know, and obviously comedy is flourishing, especially sort of interactive comedy. But, you know, and as you're talking too, what I'm realizing is what an artist does like that, like a novelist, a poet, or a painter, is they put themselves separate from society to chronicle. And so, you know, that's a burden, right? But it also is a... And I think the reason we react so strongly to the material is because it reflects something, you know, unique, because their vision of the group is different than the group. So they are deeply embedded in society, just not of it, which is why you have so much tragedy in terms of those artists. And I know when I started working at Second City, obviously Second City had this tradition of the tortured artists. You think about the John Belushis, the Chris Farleys. And one of the things, Mark Maron came by not too long ago and was laughing because he said, you know, you look at this, all these faces on the wall, and you see this history that he sees himself as part of, which is the tortured artist. And then suddenly you get to Stephen Colbert and Tina Fey and Keegan-Michael Key and Steve Carell, who are all terribly well-adjusted people who are doing just as incredible work. And sort of, you know, between us, we were saying, God, is that a myth? You know, this sort of, you know, outsider artist, do we use as a crutch for addiction or other stuff? Because these guys are doing great work, and they're pretty connected to the world. So
well,
I don't know.
I think, you know, I think it's funny because I think that that would be, you could make that observation about Jerry Seinfeld and about a lot of these guys who have done a good job, I think, of separating their craft from their own lives. I mean, in a way that maybe in the past, you know, we didn't acknowledge or permit, you know, people to be, you know, I mean, what I love about my, you know, partner De Niro from, you know, a zillion years ago, I mean, he perfected the art of being a curmudgeon.
Yep.
And his position was, look, my work is being an actor, but I'm not a celebrity, and so leave me alone at dinner. You know, in other words, he, and, you know, very few people can pull that off because when the press comes around, they want the attention, but he has been, I think the only other person like him is Rahm, you know, who says, I'm an asshole, but I'm your asshole, and so... You can live with me or not, but this is my persona. You know, most politicians have to at least pay lip service to being a good guy. And, you know, I think that it saves a lot of time, whether it's Rahm or Bruce, to just say, I'm not really interested in sort of, you know, improving your feelings. I'm interested in trying to get some important things done.
Right. Well, and yeah, because not everyone can be Tom Hanks, you know, who seems so effortlessly to communicate to everyone in the world, like he never has a bad day. And, you know, of course he does. But yeah, that's I mean, that's also a salient point to think of, you know, this generation and the sort of non-ownership, because, you know, I turned 50 this year and I love my books and I love the art that I've collected. And I like having that stuff. But my kids, you know, they're Spotify and Pandora is enough. They don't need to buy a CD. They're not interested in that. And they don't need, you know, they don't need the physical book because it can show up on their, you know, whatever reading device they've got in front of them. And it's a device.
Well, you know, that's happening in whole industries. I mean, I don't think that the car industry is ever going to be the same. I mean, I don't think people want to own cars.
No. Yeah. No, they Uber. So another thing that I find interesting, again, this, you know, you work so fiercely in a sort of a tech world and you love the sort of magic of tech. I mean, I think Every time I've actually been in your office, it usually starts with some sort of magic trick that involves a piece of technology. But given all of that, you also seem to have a very deep appreciation, again, for some of the human components that you talked about earlier. And one is listening. So I love this thing that you wrote. You go, looking for effective solutions without taking the time to carefully listen to your customers' problems is like working in the dark without a flashlight. A lot of coding and other activity may make your engineers feel better, but it's not likely to be moving the ball up the field or leading your business to a better result for your clients unless it's informed by actual and timely customer input. And you say it's the safest way to proceed because no one ever listened themselves out of a job. What is it about the importance of listening to you in business?
Well, look, I think that you know the answer to that because you can't do improv without being a fabulous listener. And honestly, what happens here is that it's a lot harder work to go out into the real world and talk to 50 customers and determine what they have as a real problem that they value, that is painful enough that they will pay fair value to have it eliminated, and then come back and build a solution. It's easy to sit in an echo chamber with a couple of other programmers and think you're reinventing the world, but you end up with the cure for no known disease or, you know, a solution in search of a problem. I mean, right. it's very hard to find real needs. And so, there's a whole methodology around lean startups, you know, like put something together, throw it out there and see if the dogs eat the dog food. I think that's a tremendous waste of time and energy because the consumers today have so many choices that if you don't hit it right, they don't want to be your beta testers. They don't want you to learn on them. They want you to solve real problems for them, and then they're willing to support you. And part two of that is if, in fact, you've identified a real problem, they'll be patient. Mm-hmm. But the people that you're trying to foist something on that you just invented in your dorm room, they won't give you a second glance. I mean, we adopt things very quickly, but we abandon them about 10 times more quickly. In fact, 70 or 80% of the applications on your phone, you will open exactly one time and never again.
Yeah. Yeah, Tumblr just reminded me that I haven't visited Tumblr in such a long time. So it's funny. We were talking this like 2 weeks ago with a scientist from IBM who worked on Watson. And the hunch we had, because they were talking about Watson doing comedy, and we were sort of saying, we were asking, we're like, have you ever thought about Watson doing improvisation? And this guy just came, he knows about improvisation. He goes, oh, robots are terrible improvisers. That was his immediate reaction. And in part because they can't experience empathetic listening. They can't read a room.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that machines will do tragedy long before they do comedy, because I think that it's actually programmatic to do tragedy.
Yep.
But the comedy is 1,000 times more difficult.
Yeah, there's a great improv phrase, which is subtlety isn't everything, it is everything else. It strikes me a piece of a digital thing is not going to pick that up. That does belong to the province of human beings, which also means when we talk about where creativity is, the intersection between humans and tech, which is why you put that art on the wall, you know, which is why the act of going out and being with people is so important, even if you end up having to go back and work with a piece of technology. The ecology and the environment that we're in is so important. I used to always use this phrase when, you know, talking about theater and what is theater, and I'm like, all theater is context. You know, any show, you got to have, you know, the idea of what it is you're seeing, the experience of where you're seeing it, because any one of those pieces falls apart, you don't get Hamilton. You know, you just don't.
I'll tell you that what we say today, I say it every day, is that the context in which you deliver your communications today is more important than the content. Hmm. And we know this as parents, because if I'm not listening, it doesn't matter what wisdom you're imparting.
Yeah, that's true.
And, you know, we're seeing more and more of this. We're so time constrained. Our attention is such a precious commodity that if you don't hit me at the exact right time and place with relevant, you know, personalized information, I just blow it off. I just don't care.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. All right. I can't believe we're coming to the end of our time. One of the things that we do on this podcast is we ask our guests to think of a time in their life where they had a no or a yes, or hopefully a yes and moment, something in their career that they said yes and to, that they decided to sort of take a chance or take a risk and build upon. I wonder if you've got something that you track back in your life that you can qualify as a yes and moment.
Well, you know, actually, I would start, you know, with 1871, because yeah. when the mayor and the governor came and said, "Would you do this?" And I had just finished Flashpoint. I was working on a book. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't high on my list to take on another, you know, gigantic undertaking. And frankly, at that time, 1871 was something between the community center and a tech treehouse.
Yep.
And so I could have said no, but in saying yes, you know, I said I'll say yes. But it's going to have to be turned into a real business, and we're going to have to say that if you're not growing, you're going, and we're not going to be a business that just has its hand out asking people to be good Samaritans. We're going to actually offer them business reasons to support us and to help us grow, and we're going to be global because we want Chicago to be on the map. So all of those were a part of saying, I'm going to sign up to do this rather than just saying, I don't need it. I'm 70, you know, years old. I didn't mm-hmm. really need another job. But it was a chance to really make a difference for the city. And I think the last 3 years, I mean, the truth is we're getting there. I mean, we're actually a place that's known. We're number one in the United States. We're yeah. number four in the world. And I think people today think of Chicago as a tech center that 5 years ago would have been a joke.
Yep.
So
absolutely.
It was a big undertaking, but it was absolutely one of those sort of junctures where I preferred to say yes.
Yeah. And anyone who goes in, if you are lucky enough to walk into the doors of 1871, it is like a giant yes and in motion in terms of all the different kinds of people who are there working on their projects. And it's such a diverse amount of work that goes on there. Howard Tallman, thank you so much for being my guest on Getting to Yes And.
All right. Thanks. And it's great to talk with you.
You too. Thanks, everybody, for listening to Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. You can find more information about Second City Works at secondcityworks.com. We'll see you next week.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine.
This is Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. You can find us at WGNplus.com. You can stream us on the WGN Plus app, or you can find us on iTunes. See you next week.